It will be that plus there may be some vomiting and some diarrhea, and you'll have a significant overall body ache and pain. Okay? And most significantly, you will have a fever. The common cold typically doesn't have a fever associated with it. Okay? And under those circumstances, you will know that you are not well. And when you are not well, the best thing you can do is to stay wherever you happen to sleep at night for the next few days. Drink plenty of fluids, take some aspirin on occasion, and hang on to the covers for the ride. That's about all you can do. You can take Tamiflu and things of that nature, but you have to do it the first 48 hours or so. It's probably something appropriate for certain select groups of high-risk people. And those people are at risk for complications of getting the flu. Okay? People who have cardiac problems, people who have respiratory tract problems, history of asthma, those kinds of things. People who are immunosuppressed, including pregnant women who are immunosuppressed. Remember that baby is only half like the mother and trying to come tumor and all that good stuff. So basically, the idea here is that mothers at risk, and children probably under the age of 5, although they probably have a greater interest in the really young ones, but under the age of 4 or 5, their immune system is not fully developed yet. So there are a few groups of people over the age of 65 and such, a few groups of people, and for the most part, you don't fit into that group. Okay? Those people are at risk for serious complications and such. Now, just to put it in perspective, tens of thousands of people die of the regular flu every year. And there's usually, in those age groups we just described, and there are usually complications, many times they're bacterial complications after having the viral infection. Just keep that in mind. What we're talking about is a flu. This is not the avian influenza, which has different risk factors and different variances and so on, and that has not yet had any serious incursions in the human kind, the bird flu, the avian influenza. Its problem right now is that it's too lethal, and it kills off 64% or more of the people that it infects, and it doesn't spread from person to person real easily because it's killing off the person who's critical. Whereas this flu we're dealing with doesn't kill that many. It's associated with 30 million people, but this could be 10 to 30,000 people. But those are generally, that's the normal year of flu. Okay. Now this flu has a little different epidemic, you know, timing, it's a little different in the summertime now, and so on. But all things considered, it's nothing to be overly concerned about. Some people are afraid to do anything. It's a typical kind of flu season. Okay. But we will see, potentially, greater numbers of people getting it. We don't know what that actual number will be. It's we've had an epidemic in 1976 of the swine flu, and as best we can tell, about 4 people died. And we really did that. And so we immunized a whole bunch of people, and we have all kinds of complications of the immunization that led to that path that we don't talk about now, which will be later. Problems with immunizations and having them being produced. But in terms of what's going on now, if you get sick, and a good number of us, even teachers and janitors and residents and so on, just have to stay home and minimize the spread to other people. And as long as you have a fever that is not under the influence of any aspirin or anything. In other words, you have to be about 24 hours after you stop taking aspirin and still have no fever. Now, for most people, this is going to be someplace around 5 to 10 days. So you should think about a preparation for maintaining your academic career. You know, to keep up on stuff, keep up on your notes. And in this course, you have the whole set of notes handed to you. And there are many people who take the course. So if you're out, get someone to take the course for you. This room has, I think, 17 speakers that go around this solo room. So Sheila will pick it up. And that's the way to do it. In other words, work together in a study group when someone's not sick, they're going to class, that kind of thing. Okay. So if you're not in a study group of 4 people or so, start forming them because that could be helpful because 1 or 2 of your 4 could be out at any given time. But you'll be able to maintain, everything's fine. spike. If you have friends or in other schools, they'll be doing the same sorts of things, and I check on them and tell them to get on the stadium. Stay current. As you all know, it's easy to be current in the first 2 weeks of pharmacy school. But after the first month and a half of pharmacy school, everybody's chasing their tail from one test to the next, at least many people are. So you want to try to avoid that because you may have a gap of a week or more in which you won't be able to do much. So when you're sick with a fever in bed with the flu, you're probably not going to be studying. Just probably not. Okay? So you just have to sort of relax, let it happen, and know it's going to be angst triggering. It's going to make you anxious that you can't be in class. And if you feel like everything's wrong, remember, you've got it now, and someone else will get it later, and so on. Your study group will maintain its integrity. Okay, we talked about capsule. The capsule is associated with pneumonia meningitis for both bacteria and fungal organisms. And we had the antigenic nature was the sugars, and very particular parts of the sugar, in fact. Very unique target. So the gentleman was composed of protein flagellin, which you will call a triple helix protein. By the way, I notice most people are writing on their notes. That's certainly your discretion to do it, but you will find your notes get filled, and having a piece of paper between the notes is a good way to do it, or a separate tab or something like that. Flagellin is triple helix protein. It is antigenic, and so there are antibodies to it, which you can then serotype the flagella. The Germans call it HUC, H-A-U-C-H, and so it's called the H-antigen. And so it will have serotypes of the H-antigen, just like we have serotypes of the capsule. And you remember it's for motility movement. And we saw the paratricus, polar, and different numbers of flagella. All of this is under genetic control of an organism, so its offspring will all have some. The arrangement and the number. Pili was composed of a protein pillar, and its function was attachment. Common pili instead attached to common things, sex pili attached to other bacteria. So sex pili are associated with a phenomenon known as bacterial conjugation, bacterial mating. We have males, plural, three types of males, and one kind of female, so we have all kinds of mating possibilities. And we'll talk about that when we talk about microbial genetics. So sex pili are not a direct virulence factor, although clearly it will change the genetics potentially. This is involved in changing the genetics of bacteria. Common pili, however, are directly involved. And we said there are two mechanisms here. We have common pili working alone or common pili working with flagella. The example of common pili working alone is when we have something like Neisseria gonorrhoeae. Now, Neisseria gonorrhoeae does not have a flagella. Excuse me, does not have a capsule. So Neisseria meningitidis has a capsule, causes meningitis, for all the mechanisms we talked about. Neisseria gonorrhoeae has common pili that attach to epithelial surfaces. And wherever these epithelial surfaces are, it will bind to that. The organism does not get in the body and spread throughout the bloodstream and then pop out someplace. It doesn't do that. Okay. What it does do is it goes where it's put and begins to colonize that particular epithelial surface. So the surfaces of our body that have receptor sites for common pili and Neisseria gonorrhoeae were the pharynx of the throat, conjunctiva of the eye, rectal mucosa, urethra, the lining of the urethra, the cervix, and the fallopian tube. So those are areas where if the organism is put there, it will grow there and cause an inflammation there. we don't talk about the P antigen, but it is antigenic. And it stimulates this inflammation. Inflammation is an immune response. We typically think of inflammation in the basic signs developed by Galen about 2,000 years ago. Inflammation is redness, swelling, heat, pain. Four hallmark signs of inflammation: redness, swelling, heat, and pain. And so the pili can trigger those events. So if you see someone who has an organism in their eye, that the conjunctiva of the eye will be all red and inflamed. As part of this inflammatory response, it will trigger the presence of lots of phagocytic cells, particularly polymorphonuclear cells. So a patient, for example, that has a Neisseria gonorrhoeae in the eye, the eyeball area will all swell up, and will actually have to sort of force open the eyelids, and out will come pus, which will be dead phagocytic cells. The white of the eye and all the conjunctiva will be all very neat, will be red. And that's what you expect to see, because the organism triggers an inflammation and lots of phagocytic cells as part of that inflammatory process. So a person who has Neisseria gonorrhoeae in their eye, who has conjunctivitis, is going to seek medical attention because this is painful and it's obvious and something's wrong. The male that has a urethral infection will have a burning sensation upon urination, and there'll be some cells there, some pus cells. And after urination, there'll be a little oozing of these pus cells. And so the underwear gets a little gooey. And so this is going to be something that's painful and something wrong, and he may seek attention. But organisms in the throat, rectal mucosa, cervix, and fallopian tube often goes unnoticed. So-called asymptomatic, although obviously if you look at that site closely, you will see the impact of the inflammation. But the patient, they're not aware of it. So one of the critical features in terms of the epidemiology, the spread of disease of Neisseria gonorrhoeae, is the presence of these asymptomatic states in which people give it to other people. They don't know they have the infection. And we'll go into more detail about Neisseria gonorrhoeae and the STDs a little later. But in terms of the common pili, it's essential that we have the attachment. That's going to be common pili. And we said that we have this strong inflammation. That's triggered by the pili as well. And finally, the pili is involved with sort of a indigestibility, if you want to call it that, of the organism. So it actually accumulates, Neisseria gonorrhoeae accumulates inside the phagocytic cell. It is not being digested. So it's in the vacuole, and it's surviving. And the pili are associated with that capacity. In fact, as we do a very quick clinical analysis, we look at those pus cells again, those phagocytic cells, polymorphonuclear cells. And as we look at those polymorphonuclear cells, inside we will find gram-negative diplococcal organisms. That we stain with the gram stain, more about that upcoming. Stain with the gram stain, it comes out of a gram-negative reaction, and it's inside the phagocytic cell. Now, there are normal flora Neisseria organisms that do not cause disease. So Neisseria gonorrhoeae and Neisseria meningitidis cause disease. But there are other species of Neisseria that do not cause disease. And when they are phagocytized, they are engulfed and gone, and that's why they don't cause disease. They're not a problem. Okay. So when we do a smear from the patient, and we see that we've got a good smear, that is, we have lots of polymorphonuclear cells, and we do a gram stain on that, we will find some organisms that are gram-negative organisms that could be Neisseria gonorrhoeae, that is, they're gram-negative and they're short coccal chain, diplococcal, and they're outside the cell, but we don't know what they really are. They could be the normal flora, or they could be Neisseria gonorrhoeae that hasn't been engulfed yet. inside, accumulating inside the phagocytic cell. That's your recovery. That's diagnostic. So we have a pretty good idea of what we're dealing with even before we've got pure culture and isolating all that stuff. And again, that's all associated with the pili. So pili was attachment. Pili was treating the inflammation. And pili was also blocking the digestive capacity, blocking the breakdown. Now they're ingested, they're brought inside, but they're not digested. So that was a common pili working alone. And again, as I mentioned last time, it is a sexually transmitted disease, and a quick thought which is not correct is, oh, sex pili, STDs, that's a no-brainer. Wrong, that's a no-brainer, wrong answer. Sex pili, bacterial conjugation, sex and bacteria. So the first example of common pili working alone is Neisseria gonorrhoeae. Second example of common pili is common pili working with flagella. Okay. And in this setting, we have a series of studies done in Scandinavian journals, and the results of which you already have some sense of what the answers are, but of course, we can always be fooled, so we do have to actually do the testing. And so, let's see if we can remember, see if we can understand some of these results. The first one was comparing the infection rates of urinary tract infections comparing men and women. So, who has a greater risk of getting a urinary tract infection, men or women? And why women? Shorter urethra. So, the female urethra is 3/4 of an inch long or so, and less. And male urethra is, well, they exaggerate, but long, right? And the length of the urethra is a factor. So we're going to play this little house game like a television program. The length of the urethra is a factor we need to consider as to what in the world is going on relative to flagella and common pili working together to cause urinary tract infection. Because we understand how they do it, we'll understand who's at risk, why they're at risk, and what we can do to overcome that risk of urinary tract infection. So we put the fact that the length of the urethra is a factor. The next study was amongst those females who were at greater risk, as compared to males, they're not at equal risk at all times. So there are certain age ranges in which females are at greater risk of urinary tract infections than other times, based on their age. And the first age range is around 2 to 3.5, 4 years of age. What's going on between 2 and 3.5, 4 years of age? Body training, okay? And so, something that guys don't have to deal with, little girls have to learn to wipe in the right direction. They want to avoid fecal contamination of the urethra. The organism that's going to cause urinary tract infections commonly, not exclusively, but commonly is found as a normal flora organism in the intestinal tract. For example, one might be Escherichia coli, a gram-negative rod. Single cell kind of thing, no cell-to-cell arrangement, no chains or anything like that. So it's just an individual cell, gram-negative, cockle-shaped, E. coli. Now there are lots and lots of organisms in the intestinal tract, upwards of 1,000 different genus. And so we have lots and lots of organisms, and one of them would be E. coli. So we don't think that E. coli is by any means the dominant one. It's outnumbered. But it is one that can cause urinary tract infection because it does have the flagella and it does have pili. And about 1/5 of fecal mass is bacteria. So fecal contamination of urethra is a factor. Again, something that little girls have to learn, wiping in the right direction as they go from the anal opening to the urethral opening, then they're going to contaminate. Guys, they learn aim and they never quite master that path. Then we have another study that indicated that women between the ages of roughly 15 and 25 or though thereabouts were also at increased risk. What's happening at that point in time? What's happening at that point in time. Yes. Who said that? Yes, what's happening then?
Copious amounts of
sex. Yes. A dreamer. We have a dreamer. So we have, yes, we have early sexual activity, which is often hard-marked by a lot of foreplay, manual manipulation of body parts, and as a result, we have, again, fecal contamination of the urethra. Physicians used to call this honeymoon cystitis, that is, cystitis from the bladder infection, associated with this early sexual activity with the concept that that was occurring during the honeymoon. So honeymoon cystitis is a nickname. But basically, that's correct, okay? Not the copious part, but the fact that it's occurring. All right. And further studies indicate there are also people at risk. So we now know that fecal contamination of the urethra is a factor. Okay. Put that on the board with the house data there. We now have an increased risk seen in patients in nursing homes and elderly patients. Not all people in nursing homes are elderly patients. We have those people who ride motorcycles, who don't wear helmets, don't drive well enough or something, head injuries, car accidents, and head injuries. And so there are people your age and younger who are in nursing homes. So not just simply the elderly, although obviously they are a dominant population. So why do people in nursing homes? And we can add to this paraplegics and quadriplegics. Why do nursing home patients, paraplegics, quadriplegics, what do they got in common?
Catheters.
Okay. So we have a Foley catheter, as it's called, which is a tube with a little donut at the end of it. It's inserted in the urethra and it sort of hangs on the entrance into the bladder. Now, if we have a problem there, if we have a urinary tract infection in those patients, the organism again is fecal contamination. Where is the organism found if we did a cross section of the urethra? We have the flow of urine where, and we have the organism where?
When the organism is on the outside of the catheter, too.
Exactly. The organism is outside the catheter, and the urine is inside the catheter. That's the purpose of the catheter, right? So the flow of urine is another factor. Put that up on the board. So we have a couple of things we have to sort of integrate into a whole to understand what's going on. Remember, we have an organism that has the ability to attach to receptor sites. And we have an organism that has the ability to swim. And urinary tract infections are ascending infections. That is, they go up the urethra into the bladder, causing a urethritis and a cystitis, bladder infection. Then up the ureter into the kidney, causing a kidney infection. And potentially from the kidney, you can get into the bloodstream, causing a septicemia. In this case, with E. coli, it would be a gram-negative septicemia. The word septicemia means increasing numbers of organisms in the bloodstream. If we use a word like bacteremia, that simply means organisms present in the bloodstream. And when you brushed your teeth this morning, you probably, or likely, potentially at least, had a transient bacteremia. Like you brushed your teeth, if there's any bleeding at all, if you have any gingivitis going on there at all, you have blood coming in, but you also have organisms from the mouth going into the bloodstream. So we have just like a little shower, a transient bacteremia. Nothing of really great concern for most people, unless you have some other anomalies in your heart valves and things. So most people, that's not a big deal, but that simply means short-term transient bacteremia organisms in the bloodstream. So we say we have a gram-negative bacteremia, that simply says gram-negative organisms in the bloodstream. If we use the word gram-negative septicemia, now we have gram-negative organisms increasing in number. And bacteremia is sort of a neutral term. You don't know the number. Septicemia is a negative term because the numbers are rising. So we can have all these things beginning with urinary tract infection, bladder infections, kidney infections, bloodstream infections, and ascending. It is ascending into the body because it has flagellum. It's swimming up into the body. So the organism is swimming up in the body, then there's a flow of urine. And now the organism is tumbling out of the body. So it's doing a backstroke or something. And now it's being pushed out. As it tumbles along, however, it's, with some degree of likelihood, going to find a receptor site for its common ion attach. So now it can hang on during the flow of urine. But it's a random event. The longer the urethra, the greater the likelihood it will find a place to be attached. But also, the longer the urethra, the longer it has to go. So the flow of urine is going to be a critical factor in the shorter urethra. So the shorter the urethra, the fewer sites to latch onto. Certain degrees are very likely to make it to the target before the flow of urine comes. So we've got some competing ideas there. That's why we had the case of the patients with the catheter. The organism was on the outside of the catheter, the flow of urine inside the catheter, and not influenced at all. And so there was no rinsing effect at all. The organism just shot right up on the outside of the urethra. Now, when you insert a urethra, when you insert a catheter, you have to lubricate it a little bit and use like KY jelly and to lubricate the catheter. The British came up with an idea about 10, 15 years ago where we put antibiotics in that KY jelly material. What do you think happened then? Fewer infections, but when the infections occurred, what about them? Harder to treat. So they actually make things worse. Well, they don't do that anymore. Should have done it in the first place, but they don't do it anymore. So we have the flow of urine being a critical feature, and that's why the short urethra is an increased risk, that's why the catheter is an increased risk. So therefore, if we increase urine flow, we'll decrease urinary tract infection. One of the other groups of people who are increased risk of urinary tract infections would be people who don't drink enough water, and college-age females are in that category if we're not careful. So we need to have water to drink, basically rinse out the urethra. If you don't drink enough and they don't urinate enough, then you increase the risk of urinary tract infection. Now, some believe drinking cranberry juice and things of that nature are a factor, thinking that the pH will influence the growth of the organism. A minor player, if at all. The main thing is the volume of increased fluid intake. That's going to be a significant factor. Okay. So simple solution, drinking more water, prevents a potential problem. What about the little lady in the catheter there? We have to take the catheter out and allow a flow of urine to rinse out. It's called maintaining the catheter. Where these staff members are crazy about this because obviously they didn't wet the bed. Sometimes people are put on a catheter because they wet the bed. You put an 85-year-old person into a rehab center and bang, they put a catheter, which increases the risk of urinary tract infection. But they put it in because it's very convenient because they've got so many people they have to maintain. So it becomes a practical problem. Talk about systems and nosocomial infections and things of that nature. Here we see a way in which the system is increasing the risk of infection. And we'll also learn that this is not necessarily an innocuous kind of simple urinary tract infection. It can get complicated, particularly in the elderly. Okay, so we got common coli. Again, antigenic nature, that was not like a key antigen, but it does stimulate an immune response. And we talked about the associated diseases. By itself, Neisseria gonorrhoeae, in conjunction with flagella, urinary tract infection. And here we see, obviously, what kind of villi? Virus-coated villi. Well, what is virus-coated villi? We can read on the front. So what kind is it? Sex villi or common can also see on the side there, on the left-hand side quite easily, you can see here that there are all this little fuzzy caterpillar-like thing, and those are the coli. Those are the young coli. These are not quite as visible here, although there's a bit of a halo. It's simply that these are in different focal planes. But this is not one without it, one with. Those are different focal planes. So there's a little lot of focus on the right side there, and as a result, you can't see clearly the coli. You can almost make it out, but not too well. And here's much better. So these are the common coli, and this is an example of sex coli. The virus is simply used as a reagent to coat it, so we can see it, make it thicker. Cell wall. Cell wall of the organism gives protection against osmotic lysis. It gives it its shape. Both the cellular morphology, which is rod, caudal, and spiral, rod, caudal, spiral, as a result of the cell wall, so it's genetically controlled by the organism. It can be a consistent feature for an organism. And also the cell-to-cell arrangement. When the cells divide, if they completely separate from one another, then we have individual cells. Rod, caudal, and spiral can all produce individual cells in certain organisms. If they don't completely separate and they divide on the same axis, then they create a chain. And we can have rod-shaped organisms in chains or caudal-shaped organisms in chains. So if we keep them on the same axis of division, it keeps dividing along the same line, and basically we get a growing chain of caudal-shaped organisms or rod-shaped organisms. And that is genetically controlled. So an organism that produces individual cells like E. coli, and that always looks like E. coli, individual cells. On the other hand, an organism like Bacillus cereus always forms chains of rod-shaped organisms. Then we can have an organism that, when it divides, it doesn't completely separate, but it rotates the axis of division. So instead of forming a chain, it forms a cluster, a ball of cells. And only caudal-shaped organisms have that potential. The word staphylococcus, such as in Staphylococcus aureus, staphylo means grape-like clusters, coccus of caudal-shaped organisms. Staphylococcus is an organism that is in a cluster. So not only the cell morphology, but the cell-cell arrangement is determined by genetics and through the function of the cell wall. Cell walls can be stained differentially. And we have different varieties and chemical compositions and different structures associated with cell wall. We have, based on a Gram stain developed by Christian Gram, who accidentally developed the stain, and that's why it's capitalized with his name, Christian Gram, around 1850, around the time of the American Civil War. He was doing a simple stain where he thought he was going to pour on a stain, rinse it off with water, and take a look under the microscope. That's a simple stain. And so he put on crystal violet, a blue color. And then either it was a bad Monday morning, or it was most likely the water was in a crock. Couldn't see what it was. And by mistake, he grabbed a crock, a vessel that contained iodine. So instead of vodka, he put on bourbon. So instead of having something that was nice and clear, water, it was, in fact, a brown color thing that is iodine. He recognized he made a mistake right away, but he was in a hurry, and it had taken a long time to air dry, and he fixed his preparation. So he said, well, you know, when I get this stuff in my lab coat, I just pour on alcohol and get it off, and maybe I'll just do that. So he poured the alcohol on. And some of the organisms, because it was a mixed culture, some of them lost their stain, some of them didn't, as they looked at the microscope. Ultimately, he learns to counter-stain a second color. So basically, we put on crystal violet, which is blue, and it's put on for like a minute. And then we pour on and then pour off iodine. And then we dump off the excess iodine and pour more iodine on for another minute. Iodine is known as a mordant. It's like the mortar pulling bricks together kind of thing. Because it forms a chemical complex with crystal violet. That's why we pour it on and pour it off. We pour it on, and any crystal violets on the outside of the cell wall will be complexed. We pour that off, and then we pour it on a second time and let it sit for a minute, and it penetrates into the cell wall. If we don't do that little rinse step there, then it sort of sticks on the outside and doesn't penetrate as well. And so we penetrate into the cell wall. Crystal violet's already there. Iodine binds with it. Okay? So now we have a blue color. When we add alcohol, some organisms' chemical structure of their cell wall is highly soluble by the alcohol. And when we add the alcohol, it will pull out and away the crystal violet, resulting in a colorless color, cell wall. On the other hand, those that don't have this highly lipid structure on the outside of your cell wall, when you pour on the alcohol, nothing much happens. So it remains blue. The last step is to add a red stain called safranin. Red stain that we add, and it makes the blue one a little purple, and it makes the colorless one red. The blue or purple is the gram positive, and the red is the gram negative. So the gram negative organism is the one that has lots of lipids in its structure, and that's why it's susceptible to the alcohol step. When students do this in the lab, they often put on too much alcohol, which becomes a common problem, too much alcohol, and they then over decolorize and they get all kinds of weird reactions. But if you do it according to procedures, it works fairly well, fairly effectively. So we have categories of organisms, gram positive, gram negative, so I say an extra apostrophe there, it just should be gram negative there. So gram positive and gram negative account for probably 95% of all bacteria. And as soon as we know we're dealing with one or the other, we already have something, an understanding what the organism, who the organism might be, the organism, the cell wall shape, cell-cell structure, so we've got cell-cell arrangement, you know its shape, you know its arrangement, and now we know its gram reaction. So we're limiting the organism. We're already beginning to identify the organism. We haven't gotten there yet, but we're moving in that direction. And we already know something about the viruses, we'll see. Gram-negative organisms have a different virulence pattern than gram-positive. So we're going to be already beginning to figure out what the patient's problems might be because they have a certain kind of organism. Now, of the remaining 5% or so that are neither gram-positive nor gram-negative, one group is acid-fast. This is one of the ones that Robert Koch was working on, acid-fast. And he developed the first stain for these acid-fast organisms. These are the mycobacterium organisms. Okay? Mycobacterium. Mycobacterium tuberculosis, mycobacterium leprae, and a wide variety of other mycobacterium organisms. In Michigan, we know about mycobis, for example, associated with cows and deer herds and so on. This is a variety of mycobacterium species. They are all acid fast. So mycobacterium tuberculosis, mycobacterium leprae, and a variety of other mycobacterium organisms. Acid fast. Okay. The term fast there simply means tightly held, not opposition to slow, like color fast or something like that. Sort of. So when we're doing the staining procedure, we add an acid alcohol rinse, and these organisms, once stained, do not lose their color. They are acid fast. Organisms that are gram-positive or gram-negative would lose their color under this acid-alcohol step. So those 5%ers are in that group of 5%ers. We have an acid-fast group. They do not lose their color under the influence of an acid-alcohol rinse. It's HCl ethanol. Now the last group of organisms mentioned parenthetically, let's say, with respect to cell wall, are mycoplasma, Notice we mentioned mycobacterium, but now we're talking about mycoplasma. Mycoplasma organisms lack a cell wall completely. So the remaining 5% include acid fast and organisms that have no cell wall at all. You recall when we put down the typical bacterial cell, we could take away the cell wall because it wasn't essential for all organisms. So mycoplasma, for example, an organism called Mycoplasma pneumoniae, an organism that causes a lung infection. Doesn't have a cell wall, not gram-positive, not gram-negative, not acid-fast. Okay. Here we see a gram-positive rod organism. And if you look at this, we see we have sort of a rough and bumpy surface there. And that rough and bumpy surface is something we call techoic acids. That's what the techoic acids are. And we have sort of a definite line. That's going to be the main component of the cell wall. And we need to occasionally see a little line, a little one here maybe, and this is a hint of something along here, and that's the membrane. The membrane's on the inside of the cell wall. And this cell is about to divide, so we can see nuclear body, these are the areas here and here. So the DNA has already doubled at this point, and the membrane will invaginate someplace in this area. It'll push in from both sides, and then it'll basically then form two cells. The main component of the gram-positive cell wall is a structure known as a murine layer. And there are only two main components. The other component is that lipotechoic acid on the rough and bumpy surface there, techoic acids. So this murine layer is the main deal. It's also known as a peptidoglycan. And the word peptidoglycan chemically describes it a little bit better than the term murine. The peptidoglycan infers we have peptides, amino acids, and glycan infers we have sugars. So we have amino sugars. And there are two, in particular, two amino sugars that are used to create this structure of the murine layer. Muriatic acid and glucosamine, and for our simple-minded purposes, we'll call them M and G for now. So muriatic acid and glucosamine are the two amino sugars that are the structure, basic structure, of the murine layer, which is the gram-positive cell wall. So when we see a cell wall, it's all covalently linked amino sugars. It's one molecule. So when you look under the microscope, you're seeing a single molecule. It's all linked together. As you might expect, it would have to be if it's going to maintain pressure from the outside of its own. You can't have gaps in the surface. Two kinds of bonding is involved in this murine layer. There's an MG bond and an MM bond. And those bondings will be critical in understanding how it's put together and how it can be taken apart. The organism is interested in how it's put together. We're interested in how to take it apart. The other component then is the techoic acid layer. So we have the outer surface of the cell wall, as you saw, rough and bumpy. And in fact, it's if you look at it on edge, you'll see these patches. It's not a continuous layer. And it actually is like a vine, you might think of it, as it winds its way through the murine layer. And so it's sort of growing within the structure, you might think of it that way. It's being put in within the structure. And if you look at it on edge, you can see little pieces. Bacterial viruses can often recognize those surface structures that we saw earlier, those rough and bumpy features, and those are receptor sites for bacterial viruses to bind to. But it's not a continuous layer. So that means the murine layer is in fact exposed to the outside, not covered completely. Here again we see this happens to be a diplococcal organism, so we have part of a cockle-shaped organism here. And we can see the peptidoglycan inside you see these occasional little ripples. And it's like two little ripples if you look at it carefully. And those two little ripples there are the membrane that divide there. The membrane right underneath it, and we have this darker core area that you see here, which is the cell wall. Take a look at those linkages. First linkage we're going to look at is the MG bond. So we have the MG, MG, MG linkage. And then we have the cross linkage, where we link the M's together. So we have two to look at. We have this one, known as linkage, MG, MG, and the cross linkage, the MN bond. Notice now we create layers. Layers of MG, MG, MG. In the case of a gram-positive organism, there can be as many as 100 layers thick. And again, you have a little bind, tetroic acid winding its way through that, but not a continuous surface. So 100 layers thick. I'm going to use a little biochemistry this morning, not too much, just a little bit. If we look at this structure, this is glucosamine, G, and this is the muriatic acid structure. If we look at our glucosamine structure, we look at it carefully, and we can see the basic structure of glucose. So inside the cytoplasm of the cell, glucose is our starting block. We're going to modify glucose. You can see that we have an amine group here. It is glucosamine, after all. And we can number these sugars that we would normally do, 1, 2, 3, 4, and so on. And so we have a 1-4 linkage between the G and the M. One carbon with a 4 carbon, beta, remember, alpha and beta, above all the surface of the plane of ring there, sugar. And so we have a 1-4 beta linkage. This 1-4 beta linkage is what only the M's and the G, and the M's and the G, and the M's and the G together. This 1-4 beta linkage is susceptible to an enzyme known as lysozyme. Now, lysozyme is an enzyme found in the following body areas. It's found inside phagocytic cells. It's a vector that contains enzymes. One of those enzymes is lysozyme. In fact, that vacuole inside our phagocytic cells, inside the PM endomacrophage, that vacuole is called a lysosome. Zone means body. Lysosome, so the body in which we find this enzyme. Now, it's not the only enzyme in the lysosome, but that is the first one, and that's why we call it. So we have a lysosome. And the source of lysosome inside the phagocytic cell. In a vacuole, inside the phagocytic cell. Then we have this found in tears. In the tear film. There are three layers of tear film. The top layer is an oily layer that reduces the amount of evaporation from your eye. In fact, patients who have a problem producing that particular oily fluid from a particular gland in the eye have a dry eye problem because the evaporation is occurring. They're not producing enough oil slick on the surface. So you have several layers, and in those layers, we have lysosome. It's also found in saliva. It's also found in vaginal wall secretions. And in seminal fluid. So we think about it, we're talking about openings to the body. Eyes, urethra, cervix. Openings to the body have this enzyme. So it should not be too surprising if you realize that the cell wall of a gram-positive organism has its murine layer, its M's and G's, right at the surface. And this enzyme is going to be whacking it apart because it breaks it down. And when it breaks it down, it exposes ultimately the membrane to osmotic lysis. So, for example, eye infections are usually not gram-positive organisms. they usually grab negative organisms. They're bacteria, like we have viral as well. In terms of bacteria, they're much more likely to be gram negative. And the gram positive organisms, such as Staphylococcus aureus, which can cause a sty, you might have heard of the sty. So Staphylococcus aureus can cause an eye infection. It's a gram positive organism. But it has a different linkage than 1,4 beta. And the enzyme can only attack the 1,4 beta. So you have a 1,3, 1,6, 1,5. There's a different possibility. But it's not a 1,4. So when you have a 1,4 linkage, it's attacked by lysosome. Urinary tract infections, likewise, are typically gram-negative organisms. Not exclusively. Sometimes Staph aureus can also cause the urinary tract infection. Again, an alternate linkage. If we look at the difference between glucosamine and uramic acid, we find that there's an awful lot of similarity, at least in part. It begins also with glucose. In fact, uramic acid begins with glucosamine. Here we have the structure of glucose, and we have the gene group here, so if we sort of take a look at this structure right here, this hydroxyl group right here, if we keep the H in place here, the rest of the molecule then is not there, and then we have glucosamine. So we substitute that H right there, make an ester bond here, and what we've got then is a series of amino acids, a tail. Now these amino acids, you don't have to memorize which ones are where, but you understand there's some common features to these. This is synthesized inside the cytoplasm, and there's a lipid carrier molecule that brings it out with a long chain. MG, 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 sort of a prefab home kind of thing coming out. And as it comes out, there are 5 amino acids here. They're typically alternating L and D forms. And the last 2 amino acids are usually adenine. So alternating except for the last 2. Double alanine or something like that. So we have alternating L and D forms. So the alternating L and D forms gives it protection against typical proteolytic enzymes. When you talk about proteolytic enzymes, trypsin, chymotrypsin, and those kind of things, basically, they're not going to be able to break down an alternating L and D form of the amino acid block. So that makes it stable against those kind of attacks. The alternating L and D forms also pack more closely to one another, more densely. Remember, we're going to have to do layer after layer after layer here, and we got these tails in the way, so let's crunch the tails down so they're more dense. So this is synthesized as the basic unit. Now, when it is synthesized, we receive 1, 2, 3, 4. There are 5 when it is biosynthesized and shipped out as a prefab. 5 amino acids in the tail of uramic acid. In the structure itself, though, this structure, this is the linkage here, the M's are linked with M. When the M is linked with another M, the M's involved have only 4 amino acids. So the process of doing the cross-linking, one of the amino acids is cleaved. Now, if you think about it, this is a building project, much like building a space lab or something, International Space Station. You're building this structure, you're making bonds, and there's no available electrons. So what we do is we have the double alanine, number 4 and number 5. There's an enzyme that pulls that last one off, and those electrons then are used to link one end with the next end. So the electrons necessary to bond uramic acid with uramic acid in the cross-linking, those electrons in that bond were originally found in the double alanine with the double amino acid bond at the tail. So within the structure, when it looks like this, there are only 4 amino acids. When it was biosynthesized, the prefab unit coming out from the cytoplasm, there were 5. Here we have a 1-3. Remember we've mentioned that Staph aureus could have altered the 1-3. So this 1-3 then is not affected by lysozyme. Lysozyme being sensitive. An example of an altered link. Now the cartoonist who did this, picking from the textbook, screwed up a little bit. See, they've got missing amino acid there, so you have to put another DLU right there. So we have 4 and 4. And when we do that, we have the last of one group of 4, was once 5, now is 4, is linked to the next to the last, which is glutamic acid right there, of the other. It's next to the last linked to the last, which allows this next to the last chain here to be linked with the next one, for the next row. Ferris has a golf tournament in the summertime for one-armed golfers. And at the banquet, the student who wins the prizes and so on, and the banquet after the tournament, if they all hold hands, how big are the groups? Two. Okay. Whereas if you all did a little come by down and you all held your hands together, it could be one big group. Okay. So if we link last to last, we only have 2 layers. By linking last to next to last, we have 100. Slight little change, but has a significant impact on the overall structure. So last to next to last. Now this linking right here is greatly abbreviated. It's usually a series of amino acids. Maybe 5 glycines or something like that. So we might have a pentaglycine. But remember, this is going to change from organism to organism, so don't memorize that. But we're going to have a bridge here. A bridge of a homopolymer repeating subunits of amino acid. So that's really what's doing the connection. What links the last to the next to last is a chain, and not the regular thing that's shown here. And if you think about it, it's got to stretch a little bit because we've got some distance to go between one MG and MG to the next MG. So here we're linking one MG with another MG. Well, one of the things we want to learn in the course is how do we learn things? And how do we learn what I just told you? How do we learn that we have 4 amino acids in the structure and there were originally 5 amino acids and all that stuff? The University of Minnesota did an interesting study. And they were looking at the mechanism of action of a new drug at the time. They didn't know how it worked. This is generally how it worked in the cell wall. We didn't know how. Called penicillin. Okay. We now have many penicillins, plural. We have derivatives of the natural compound. There are several sporins, which Keflex, Keflin, which work on the same mechanism, but it's a different mold product, and so on. Penicillin producing penicillin, cephalosporin producing cephalosporin. So we have study in which we basically grow the organisms in the presence of penicillin in a balanced osmotic solution. Now when we do this, the cross-linking is not allowed to occur. We block the cross-linking. And the MG-MGs unravel layer after layer after layer, like layers of an onion. So the MG-MG bond is not affected, but the linking, cross-linking is blocked. And basically then exposed to the membrane, to osmotic lysis, and so the penicillin kind of compound, penicillin and others, are cell wall synthesis inhibitors. They block the making of the cell wall and result in a bactericidal effect. They kill the bacteria through osmotic lysis. So penicillin and similar compounds block the making of the cell wall, unraveled in various layers of MG-MG, or they don't get the crosslink, and then we have osmotic lysis. And if we look at the murine layer, and we look at the muriatic acids that are in that have come from these cells that were grown in the presence of penicillin, and in the presence of osmotically balanced solution, if we look at what happened to those fragments, they have 5 amino acids on them, just as they came out from the cell. So penicillin blocked the cross-linking step. It blocks the knocking off of that last amino acid. So there's an enzyme that recognizes that bond. And that enzyme that breaks the fourth and fifth apart, and then connects then the fourth to the next one. The next murmur has to be the third. So we have the fourth to the third, the last to the next to the last. This idea that we use penicillin to learn about the structure of the cell wall, we call this general idea a conceptual probe. How do we learn about the structure of the cell wall? By understanding more fully the mechanism of action of penicillin. So we have two ways of taking apart the murine layer. We have lysozyme and we have penicillin. And penicillin-like compound. The actual structure of the penicillin is called a beta-lactam ring. Beta-lactam. L-A-C-T-A-M. Lactam. The beta-lactam ring. It's a four-membered ring structure. And apparently the enzyme that does the cross-linking has a greater binding affinity for the beta-lactam ring than it does for these fourth and fifth amino acids put together. And therefore, when penicillin is around, that enzyme is bound to beta-lactam ring and is not available to do its cross-linking. It's different binding affinity. And so there's a beta-lactam ring in penicillin and all the semi-synthetic derivatives of penicillin, like methicillin and ampicillin and so on. And the cephalosporins, they have a beta-lactam ring. And all the various generations of cephalosporin, Keflex and Keflin, and you'll get all that a little later. But all of these are cell wall synthesis inhibitors. So penicillin blocks the maintenance of cell wall, whereas lysozyme destroys the already made cell wall. That's an important difference. Lysozyme attacks the already made cell wall. Penicillin interacts with the making. It's called a cell wall synthesis inhibitor. Now, what we need to do in this course, in part, is for you to understand the science, but understand how it's applied to a clinical setting, and be able to explain it to a patient in a meaningful manner. The patient doesn't need to know the science. They need to know enough about the mechanism of the action of the compound so that they can faithfully follow the directions that you give them. In this particular case, you have to translate what we just talked about to a practical setting. So if you take a penicillin, you take it just one day in your bed. Now, how long do you take penicillin? Okay. 7, 8 days, something like that, 10 days. So you take it for a number of days, and it will stop making the cell wall of any organism that's divided. It has no effect on the already made cell wall, only on new cell walls, on the making of a cell wall. So when a cell is dividing, it's susceptible to penicillin. If a cell is not dividing, it's not susceptible to penicillin. So therefore, in combination therapy, we want to probably stay away from using a bactericidal agent and a bacteriostatic agent. In this case, use something, bacteriostatic agent sort of keeps the organisms together, and that sort of starves them, prevents them from dividing. Bacteriostatic means same number of organisms, okay? So the numbers don't grow. Well, if it's not growing because of the effect of the bacteriostatic compound, then if those penicillin, it's not going to work too well. Because it only works in the growing cells. So you got one drug saying, don't grow. The other one says, please grow so I can kill you. That's a conflict. So we understand basic mechanisms, we can avoid some problems. Now what about how this affects? Now we take this for 10 days, let's say. Arbitrarily, 7 to 10 days. Let's say 10 days. On the first day, the first hours, most of the organisms are dividing. So therefore, you're going to kill off a whole bunch of bugs. And in fact, in 48 hours, if penicillin is working, or this cell wall synthesis inhibitor compound is working, the patient's probably going to start feeling better because we've killed off a lot of the organs. But we haven't gotten rid of them all. In fact, there'll be some bugs that are going to wait around day 7. Okay, now I'm going to die. I was just sleeping, I was watching the game 9 days ago. And so I did get out there and get run over by the truck and the truck. So I just went out. I was in the Bible. What are we doing? So as soon as I go out and do something, I have to get hit. So as soon as the cell begins to divide, it's then susceptible. But it's not a synchronous growth. They're not all dividing at the same time. It's asynchronous. They're dividing at different times. And only the ones that are dividing are affected. So by day 6 and day 7, we're getting most of the copies of all until day 10, we've got them all. They all attempt to divide, and we've all been killed. But we killed most of them in the first 48 hours. So what does this mean to the patient? So now we know why we treat for 10 days, because we're not going to get all the bugs unless we do. And if we don't get them all, we'll have a problem. The bug will come back. But the patient needs to be told, not all the science stuff, but you need to take this for 10 days, let's say, whatever it is. And you might even tell them, you know, it's probably going to be showing you, you're going to start feeling better the next day or two. But still take the drug. If you don't say that latter part, they're going to feel better and they're going to say, I'm cured. I don't need to do this. So then you have this little case study. You have George. George goes to the doctor with a bacterial infection and he's given a penicillin compound. And he's back again. 3 weeks later, he's back. And the doctor says, gee, George, seems like you still got the same bug. I'll give you some more penicillin. And George says, that's okay, Doc. I got plenty of other pills from last time. Yeah, because you didn't take it all. That's why you're back again. Okay. One of the main reasons for antimicrobial treatment failure is patient non-compliance. They don't follow the directions. So one of your jobs is going to be convincing the patient to do the right thing and follow the directions. And you can gain a little trust in him. Maybe you know what you're talking about. When you tell them, they feel bad right now, they're going to feel better in just a couple of days. But still, when you start to feel better, still take it until it's all gone. Okay. And then they feel better in 2 days. Well, you know, the pharmacist said I would feel better. And they also said I should take it until it's all gone, so I guess I'll do that. You don't have to tell them about the pain like that and rain and all that sort of stuff. And that's where you're coming from. Okay. So you need to translate the science into practical medicine. And know where to cut corners and where not to cut corners. You know, if you know the essence of things, you know how to work with it. So that's a conceptual probe. Penicillin, the mechanism of action, allows us to understand cell wall structure. Case of gram positive. Gram negative. Liberal polysaccharide layer. We have an LPS layer that has something to do with what we call the coantigen side chain. We also have something known as lipid A or an endotoxin. So there's some new terms here. And we've got our one that we've already discussed now, a murine layer. So there's a murine layer in the gram negative as well. In fact, as we talk about it, there's a murine layer in the acid fast as well. So all three types of cell walls have a murine layer. In the case of gram positive, that is most with the exception of a little patchy pectoric acid. So now we see a murine layer, but it's going to be buried, just as it is in the cell. Here we see the so-called outer membrane. That's an interesting term. Outer membrane. And we have a periplasmic space, or periplasm. And then we have an inner membrane, or a cytoplasmic membrane. So we see this funny multiple layers. And that's going to be indicative of a gram-negative cell wall. Seemingly outer membrane phenomenon. Now we can see it better. Here we see the outer membrane, and it's from the murine layer out. And then we have this murine layer, so it's around, let's put it up like that. And on the inside of that is the membrane. So when we're talking about the gram positive, it was just the protoglycan and membrane. But now we've got all this other stuff, and it's on the outside, and it completely hides the peptidoglycan. And this other stuff includes lots of lipids. Now, just step out of the lecture for a second, just think for a second. If I'm trying to get down to that murine layer with a drug that will stop the making of the murine layer, the cell wall synthesis inhibitor, got up beta-lactam ring on, but it encounters all of this lipid on the outside. The lipids can be hydrophilic or hydrophobic. It's going to be very hydrophobic, much more than it's the case of a gram positive. So we're going to have to modify that drug a little bit to get through that hydrophobic surface so it can get down into where it's going to do its work. The natural compound of penicillin doesn't do that. So we had to modify some of the R groups in penicillin, maintaining the beta-lactam ring, but modifying the R groups so we can penetrate that. So anytime we have, so then we had an ampicillin. We call that broad spectrum because we're receiving both gram positive and gram negative. And we had to modify it because of the surface structure being these, all these lipids, this outer membrane. So when we talk about a broad spectrum compound, it means it can penetrate this lipid layer of the gram negative. Gram positives are easy to do. Gram negatives got, you know, an issue, they have issues, but we can get around those issues. But we have to recognize what the problem is. It's this hydrophobic surface, so we have to get around that. It still has a target, peptidoglycan, so once we get our beta-lactam ring down there, it'll do its job. So what's all this stuff out here? We've got lipoproteins, and then we have phospholipids. The phospholipids are the basic structure of a membrane. So we see these little circles here with little strings on them, side chains, right? And they are hydrophilic and then hydrophobic at the tail. And then there's a hydrophobic tail, and then there's another hydrophobic. So we got this hydrophilic-hydrophobic interaction, just like we did with a membrane down here. So these components of the membrane are oriented with respect to water, hydrophilic and hydrophobic. So they've got the same molecules, phospholipid here, shown here in water type, shown down here as part of the membrane. This phospholipid is called an amphipathic molecule. It has two orientations with respect to something. In this case, it's got two orientations with respect to water. One part likes water, the other part of the same molecule hates water. When you mix amphipathic phospholipids with an aqueous solution, you will form a membrane. Okay. Or as you saw in last week's lecture, you will form initially a micelle. Okay. And if you keep loading this micelle, which is round, if you keep loading it up, it basically flattens out. When it flattens out, you have a membrane. Just a natural characteristic of an amphipathic molecule with respect to water, and you put it in an aqueous solution, you will naturally form micelle and membrane. So we have the basic structure then in terms of hydrophilic hydrophobic portions. We have this pore structure, porin, and all it is sort of like an ionophore. That is, it's sort of like a sheltered area that we can move charged molecules through. So this is sort of a hollow in the middle, and it'll bring it down to this point, getting it by some of this sort of thing. So some drugs can enter in that way. We also have proteins that go right through this membrane. They're often transport structures, just like you can see them down here. They bind at one end, and then they'll get a conformational change, and it'll transfer to the other end, just like we see in a regular membrane. So we have porin structures, and we have proteins, and we have lipoproteins, and we have phospholipids. But our main thing we want to look at is this thing right here, lipopolysaccharides. LPS. It's got a little core area referred to as the common antigen. And this core compound contains a lipid known as lipid A. Now they're all covalently linked. The lipid A is inside this core or common antigen. Further we move away from this core, and here we can see this so-called core polysaccharides. Once we move beyond the core polysaccharides out here to the so-called O antigen side chain, so you might want to modify your graph there and indicate this is an O antigen side chain, which is O polysaccharide, O antigen side chain. And these are unique sugars out here. So the core polysaccharide, including the lipid A box, endotoxin, have a name for it. Lipid A is endotoxin, we'll talk about that in a second. All this core is common to most, if not all, gram-negative organisms. So there's very little change here. So we
compare Shigella, gram-negative rod, with Salmonella, gram-negative rod, with cholera, a gram-negative rod, with Klebsiella, a gram-negative rod, with E. coli, gram-negative rod. These are all going to look the same under the microscope. Some short gram-negative rod, Shigella, cholera, Salmonella, E. coli. This is all going to be the same. But even within E. coli, or within Salmonella, or whatever, the O antigen side chains will be unique. So there will be a wide variety of possible, even for such things as E. coli, there will be many, many serotypes of O antigen side chain. These are unique sugars, sometimes only found in nature in this structure. Now, sugars, of course, are good antigens, so we can serotype these. We can serotype the O antigen side chains. Now, to be perfectly clear, we can also make antibodies to the core polysaccharides, the core sugars, but that won't distinguish E. coli from Salmonella, let alone various varieties of E. coli from one another. They're all the same. So it's not interesting to us when we're trying to find differences. But the side chains, now we've got changes. Now it's called the O antigen, and this is one of the mistakes that the Germans made when they were naming things. Remember we had the H antigen, Hulk? That means it had flagella and motility. Well, they thought the world was divided into those that had flagella and those that didn't, and they thought that was a big difference. So the ones without flagella were without Hulk, or they were onaHulk, O-N-E-H-A-U-C-H, onaHulk. And that simply means without flagella. They missed the whole idea of gram-positive and gram-negative. Okay. And so that naming is out of whack. Because gram-negative organisms all have the O-antigen. So they all have the O antigen side chain. Some of these are flagella, and some do not. Okay. So E. coli, for example, has the H antigen because it is flagella. It has the O antigen side chain as well. Now, if we just think about it as H and O antigens as a label, no problem. If we go back to the original German, it makes no sense. With and without flagella is what I really need. So they screwed up. But we live with the that, and we don't get too technical about it, we don't worry about it, but we do recognize that we have O antigen side chains. Okay. And we use those O antigen side chain serotypes coupled with the H antigen serotypes, and we use that for epidemiological purposes. For example, E. coli H7O157, okay. E. coli with the flagella antigen 7, 8, 7. O157, that means the O antigen side chain 157th sugar. H7O157 is associated with a hemorrhagic form of E. coli problem. That's the fifth grader who's eating lots of hamburgers, who eats raw hamburgers in the summertime, and comes down with a diarrheal problem that eventually gets into the kidneys and causes kidney failure. In the emergency room, they even kill them. We'll talk more about food poisoning later, but H7O157 is an example of an H and O serotype of an organism, for example, E. coli. So we do that for epidemiological purposes, to track diseases. And we can track H7O157 from the sick 5-year-old, for the fifth grader, the sick fifth grader, to the hamburger, to the slaughterhouse, to the farm, and to the cattle that came from. And that organism is in the intestinal tract of the cattle that it came from. So we can trace it all the way back, epidemiological. But it's better to see. So it's not just simply enough to know that it's E. coli. You need to know the serotype of E. coli. Remember, that's genetically determined. Take a look at this little box. That was where we have the lipid A structure. It's attached to these common sugars here. This lipid A structure is here. Okay. Core polysaccharides, our lead one here is something known as TGO. And then we have a variety of others, part of the core, and we have the O antigen side chains here that are in the light purple. So this was our box, and these are the four polysaccharides and the side chains. This structure right here is lipid A structure, also known as endotoxin. So chemically it's lipid A, but in terms of sort of a pathophysiology, what does it do? Endotoxin. It's a poison inside the cell wall of the organism. It's released upon the death of the organism. Now there's a little bit of shedding in the process of making cell walls. You know, when you're building a building, there's always some debris, some old bricks, and some mortar laying around, and pieces of lumber to scrap. That's true. So there's a little bit of spin-off when you're making a cell wall. There's a little leakage. But it's major time release when the cell is killed. Now, when it's released in the bloodstream, it triggers a cytokine shower effect. Now, cytokines are cell signals coming from cells of your immune system. It's how your cells and the immune system communicate to one another. But in this case, it's an exaggeration. Instead of communicating, they're yelling at each other. And they're not very efficient, coordinated, and chaos that occurs. And this chaos results in cell problems throughout the body. For example, it will activate some of the cytokines in the interleukin system, such as interleukin-1, and interleukin-1 will trigger fevers in a patient. Interleukin-1 adjusts the hypothalamus set point for the body. And so now the patient will have a fever because set point has been changed. So instead of being 37, the body is told to be at 39. And so we suddenly start heating up to make that 39 target, which gives us a fever. Cytokines can also be triggered in the case of influenza, as we talked about fevers there. It's not unique to this by any means. But here we have a cytokine shower. It also causes some other changes. It changes interleukin 3 and 4 and some other interleukins. Series will change the permeability of the blood vessels, making them leaky. And now fluid will leave the blood vessels. And when the fluid leaves the blood vessels, the cells behind are still there, so the viscosity, the thickness of the blood increases, and the volume of the blood decreases. This can be significant. We can have a situation where we can't get a cuff reading on blood pressure. No blood pressure. That can't be good. We've lost so much fluid into the tissue. But even the thickness of blood can put a stress at the pump. Most people's hearts are pretty strong, even under the influence of this thickening situation of the bloodstream, the heart keeps pumping. But some people have an underlying problem. And those underlying problems can be exacerbated or made worse. And so we have patients that may trigger arrhythmias in. And they may have a failed arrhythmia. Okay. So their heartbeat gets all messed up. Fluid, when the heart is not being very efficient, fluid builds up in the pericardial sac. And that pushes against the heart as it beats, so that makes it even more of a problem for the heart. And fluid can build up around the lung in the pleural cavity. And so now as you breathe in, you have to breathe in and you're fighting against the fluid there as well. So that will put stress on the cardiovascular system. The people are able to survive that fluid unless they have underlying problems. If you have underlying problems, this is going to make it worse, it's going to be fatal. But usually what kills the patient, and it will kill the patient, is kidney problems. So we have loss of fluid, but we also have a loss of electrolytes. That loss of fluid and electrolytes will put the patient into renal shutdown and then ultimately renal failure. And the patient will die of kidney failure. All of this because of endotoxin. So that gram-negative septicemia can be fatal. And if the patient has any risk factors, they're going to come into play as well. So let's put this into a clinical context. We have Aunt Susie. Aunt Susie's in the hospital. She's in a nursing home, in fact. From the hospital to the nursing home, she's a little mentally confused. Nobody can take care of her at home. She put her in the nursing home. While she's in the nursing home, she wets the bed. Nursing staff puts a catheter in. Doctor says she has a little bit. So now she has nothing wrong with her physically. She's a little confused. In fact, she sometimes takes the catheter out. They put it back in. Then she develops an infection. What first happens is she keeps taking this catheter out because it hurts. And she tells them that it hurts. And they say, that's okay, Catherine, it's okay. She's so confused. Aunt Kathy, okay, so we have a little confused, and so they say, oh, that's okay. Well, the painful urination is the first sign of a urinary tract infection. That's why she's taking it out. But that's overlooked. She's lying flat on her back all the time, but she has flank pain, back pain, because she has kidney problems now. And she also had the increased frequency of urination and the sense to go to the bathroom, but that's all masked because you have a catheter. So the burning sensation, the urgency to go all the time, even though you're not producing much urine, all signs of urinary tract infection are missed on her. The back pain, you're laying in your back, you know, just turn over a little bit. Nursing staff misses that too. So now it goes up in the kidneys. And now the first thing she has is she has a fever. My goodness, they take her temperature all the time, she has a fever. Something's not right. So the first alarm that's recognized by the nursing staff was a fever. It is the fourth thing they could have recognized, but they got the first thing, this is their first recognition. Well, it's one data point. So it's 6 o'clock in the morning, we'll wait. So they wait till 10 o'clock, and they take the temperature again, and it's up again. So now they call the doctor who services the nursing home, and he'll make note of that when he comes around. This is around about 4:30 in the afternoon. So now she's been sick for quite a while. And at 4:30, he says, oh my goodness, let's take her, rush her to the emergency room. So they take her to the emergency room. By now, she has hardly any pulse. She has hardly any blood pressure. She is going into kidney failure. They call this endotoxic shock. Gram-negative septicemia. Within 2 days, she's dead. But, you know, she was an old lady. You know, things happen. No, this is a systems problem. This is a nosocomial problem. The system killed her. Had she not been in the nursing home with a catheter, she probably wouldn't have had a urinary tract infection. Had she been home, she might have had someone say, wait a second, maybe you've got some problems here, and they go to the doctor a little sooner. But the system didn't allow for all that. All the safety switches were all taped down. And it wasn't until she had a fever that they recognized it might be a problem, and that took hours before they did anything. So people die all the time, and of course, in nursing home setting, and of course what's written on here is that she died of gram-negative septicemia. There's no backtracking. There's no, well, let's see, why did she have the gram-negative septicemia? Because she had a kidney problem. Why did she have a kidney problem? She had a bladder problem. Why did she have a bladder problem? She had a catheter. And they didn't maintain the catheter by taking it out. Simple solution to the problem. We understand that maintaining a catheter reduces urinary tract infection, increasing urine flow. We have older people who are dehydrated. Simple things like dehydration lead to a set of circumstances that kill people and lead to very expensive medical interventions and all that kind of thing. If you understand the mechanism of the disease, how the organism is causing the problem, we can intervene early and inexpensively, keeping people alive for a lot longer and cheaper. Okay. Now, here we have endotoxin, and the Japanese group used an interesting conceptual probe to find out what part of the lipopolysaccharide is associated with all this nastiness. What part of it is causing endotoxic shock? And so their probe was a genetic probe. Before we used an antimicrobial agent. Now we use a genetic probe. How do we learn about the information? They did a variety of mutants of Salmonella. And each of the mutants had a shorter and shorter side chain. So they had mutants that had
this cut here, and then mutants cut here, and then mutants cut here. And all these mutants cause death in mice. And then they cut down on the core polysaccharide, and they cut it down still on the endotoxic shock in your animals. And it was down to the point of KDO. If they went less than KDO, they couldn't maintain viability of the organism. It's so long, the mutant wouldn't survive. And so they recognized then that this lipid A structure is really the endotoxin. This lipid A structure is really the toxic component. The rest of it is not. So how do we know that? Except for probe genetics. A variety of mutants of salmonella, what we're doing. Acid fat. Acid fat. Highly lipid. So we're going from lots of lipids to a whole bunch more. So this is even more lipids, more hydrophobic than the gram-negative. And the structure that is key there is really a wax. And that wax is mycolic acid. So mycolic acids contribute to the high lipid, even waxy surface of an acid fast organism. Mycobacterium organisms such as Mycobacterium tuberculosis, Mycobacterium leprae, and a wide variety of other mycobacterium organisms such as mold and so on, that we'll talk about in the course. But these mycobacterium species have mycolic acids, lots of lipids, and then buried under all that, they too have a murine layer. But this is so hydrophobic that we can't get down to that layer of the drugs. Can't do it. There's only a handful of drugs that we can actually use to treat mycobacterium species. In fact, there are some highly resistant forms of mycobacterium tuberculosis that are difficult to treat. And there are a few that are not treatable with antibiotics, few isolates. We're always concerned that it can become a major event. It hasn't yet. Resistance is growing, but it's not an immediate emergency as we thought it might have been. So we have mycobacterium species, very hydrophobic. So let's think how this is going to work with how the ability to cause disease. Got this hydrophobic surface. So what happens when a mycobacterium organism comes in contact with a phagocytic cell? What's going to happen? It's going to be engulfed, okay? Rapidly engulfed. Remember, we have sugar-coated hydrophilic surfaces that we added opsonizing antibody that made the immune complex hydrophobic which got involved. Don't need that anymore. Antibodies are not part of the picture here. Antibodies are not going to be part of the detective immune response. They're not going to be of any significant clinical significance. Because of what antibody does, it doesn't need to be done because it's already hydrophobic. Now, once it gets involved, because it's got this mycolic acid surface, it doesn't get digested. So it gets ingested, but not digested. And eventually it gets sort of, keeping the metaphor going, burped back out. It gets injected. But it's still a desirable hydrophobic compound, so it gets picked up by another one. In fact, you see these cells have these frenzies where they're picking them up and burping them out, picking them up and burping them up. We get the organism tuberculosis into our body in three different ways. We can eat the organism, and our mesenteric lymph nodes with popular phagocytic cells will begin this frenzy. Or we can get the organism in a wound, let's say in our hand or leg or something, and our regional lymph nodes will be involved in it quickly, within 48 hours or so, with this frenzy. Or you can breathe the organism in on droplets and get it in the lungs, and then we have the lymph node structure around the lungs and the alveolar macrophage will be gobbling it up and spitting it out. Now the organism is sort of interesting in that this organism also has another characteristic about it that's sort of unusual. It divides real slowly. Now typical organisms like E. coli and Staph aureus, they divide every 20 minutes or so. The treasurer. Yes. It's your money box, folks, rolling around the ground. So it divides, most of the organisms will divide every 20 minutes or so. Organisms that cause tuberculosis, this group of organisms, the mycobacteria, divide every 18 hours, every 24 hours, every 36 hours. Hours instead of minutes. Really slow. So this is going to be a slow, ongoing catastrophe in the body. And it is coupled by this frenzy of fighting to get your food. Antibodies don't work. So our body is going to basically put it in prison. We're going to have our T cell lymphocytes, part of our cell-mediated immunity, CMI. Our T cell lymphocytes, part of our cell-mediated immunity, will wall the organism off. Remember, it's not really rapidly growing, so we can do this. And we wall it all off in a granuloma. So a granuloma is a walled-off area. T cells are key in maintaining this granuloma. T cell lymphocytes. After a few weeks, this granuloma will begin to calcify. One of the body's reaction is to form a calcium crud around things. If you have ligament damage or tendon damage, you'll get a calcium deposit around the wounded area. The same thing we can do here, we get this calcium buildup. And now it's radiopaque, so we can see it. So we do a chest x-ray in the person, we'll see this little cannonball, little round granulomas. And inside the granuloma is the organism. Now the T cell is doing its best, it's releasing all kinds of cell signals, and the macrophages are doing their best, they're trying to digest it. And T cells are actually sending signals to the macrophage to help them digest it, but it's a real inefficient process. So the basic thing is, imprisonment, wall off. Some instructors will call it a cellular amputation. That area has lost function, it's no longer functioning as a lung, but you've got the organism in prison. I say the lung because the organism can enter the body in many different places, but it's gonna concentrate in areas of the body that have high amounts of phagocytic activity. And what were those areas of the body? Lungs and the lining of the brain. And so, does it occur in the lining of the brain? Yes. And does it occur in the lungs? Yes. So, we have meningitis associated with mycobacteria tuberculosis, and we have tuberculosis, an infection in the lung. All of this is because it's got this hydrophobic structure, this thing that can't be resisted by the phagocytic cells, but then can't be digested either. Antibody doesn't work. Now, we can skin test you to find out if this battle is going on, because we'll take a little bit of extract of the organism, put it in your skin, and we'll skin test you, and all of you will be skin tested periodically. We take an extract of the organism called PPD, purified protein derivative of tuberculosis, and we inject it into your skin. Or we can put it on a little roughed up area with a band-aid on it. So we have a little roughed up area, it's called a patch test, put a band-aid on it, put a patch on it. You'll look at about 40 hours to see your redness. Redness is going to be there because you have a cytokine release where you have extracted the organism. Or we can inject it into your skin in a process called a Mantoux test, M-A-N-T-O-U-X. The Mantoux test will determine your lymphocyte response to this. If you've never seen it before, you don't get a red spot. If you've seen it before, you get a redness and swelling in that area of the injection. But more details about that when we get to it. Organisms and have problems in the lung. We want to focus in our whole function here of this process is that its surface is very, very hydrophobic. So we saw organisms with capital hydrophilic. Our body responded with an antibody, which made the immune complex hydrophobic, which involved and killed it. Here we see an organism that's naturally hydrophobic, readily gets involved, but that same structure, mycolic acids don't prevent the digestion. So we have to use another system. And that's the cell-mediated immune response. Cell membrane. Next structure in. Composition phospholipid structure. So we have a structure of the phospholipids, those amphipathic molecules. And the protein provide function. So basically, a membrane is two things. Structure, function, phospholipids by the structure, function divided by the protein. Simple little diagram here, you can see a phospholipid molecule, empty packet molecules, hydrophobic, hydrophobic groups, hydrophilic on the outside and on the inside, and our tail, hydrophobic barrier. And we see these little peanut kind of structures. Okay? Some of these are shown here, go all the way through the membrane. And they can be involved in transport. So the membrane can be involved in the selectively permeable structure, membrane transport. We also have the structures that are only on the outside or only on the inside. They're basically substitutes for a phospholipid group. For example, ones only on the inside are associated with the electron transport system and making ATP. Remember, the bacterial membrane does that. And so this process of making ATP is occurring at the sort of the inner shore of this lipid sea. Think of the membrane as a lipid sea, a fluid structure, not a rigid structure like a cell wall. And on the inside of this is where we see ATP is made. If you isolate some of the enzymes involved in making ATP, if you isolate these enzymes, their specific activity is really low. But if we add lipids to it, the specific activity increases. Why do you think that's the case? Why is it that these proteins require a lipid for full function? Why would that be? I mean, if the protein does the job, I mean, why does it need to stop?
What does the lipid do? The lipid's not converting enzyme to substrate. The
protein is. What's that? Hold it in place for the right activity sites are shown on a very close idea. Basically, it stabilizes the structure, which is essentially what we're saying. Stabilizes the structure. And you have the boat and chair thing going on and all that. So you have a protein which has too many degrees of freedom. It doesn't get focused on its job. And if you attach it to this, you can only attach it a certain way because of the chemical nature of the two entities. And once it does so, then it's now in an active form. So it puzzled the researchers initially because you get it in pure form and it doesn't work very well. And you add back a little lipid that does nothing, you know, the enzyme. But here we have this stabilized structure. We mentioned that the flagella was anchored in the membrane. And you don't need to memorize all these different parts. Key rings and MNS rings, don't worry about that. Just recognize that it's anchored in the membrane. It extends through the cell wall structure. And anchored in the membrane where it gets ATP so it can then spin. Remember this is triple helix protein here with plasma, with gel. Gram-positive, gram-negative organism here. Gram-negative. So we said E. coli is a gram-negative organism. You see the outer membrane and so on. So just by looking at it, you should know that you're dealing with gram-negative and all that that it means. So, specific transports involved with the membrane. And that's linked, of course, to the osmotic barrier. Only things we get inside are necessary. So anything larger than glycerol, which is not a particularly large molecule, and anything with a charge, regardless of its size, has to go through a specific transport. So anything with a charge, and anything larger than glycerol. So that's most of everything. So very few things get in and out of the membrane all on its own. And if it did, then if you're high concentration of whatever that was, you'd end up with osmotic lysis. Well, if you're low concentration, you'd end up with osmotic lysis. So this controls. We control the imports and the exports. Nothing gets in or out of the cell without going through a specific transport. And we also have the production of ATP, the electron transport system. A bit about mycoplasma. We mentioned that earlier. So we have mycoplasma pneumoniae, where it is, we said, doesn't have a cell wall. So that means it has a membrane. But we also said, in the case of penicillin with a gram-positive organism, or a suitable
broad-spectrum cell synthesis inhibitors of gram-negative organisms. We take away the murine layer and expose the cell membrane to the outside, and it then lyses. So why in the world can mycoplasma, how does it survive? How does it do that? It doesn't have a cell wall. It's just its membrane. So if you think for a second, we find a couple of things we'll put up on the top board here, this guy. Your cells have cell walls? No. So your cells don't have cell walls, that means you just have a cell membrane. So it is possible, like mycoplasma, somehow you can survive. So we got the idea of human cells, animal cells. Every cell survives like that. Well, I guess it's possible for mycoplasma. How do they do it? Well, how do your cells survive osmotic lysis if you don't have a cell wall? Is there a component in your cell wall? What's in your cell wall? In your cell membrane. What's in your cell membrane that makes it stable? Cholesterol. Okay. So cholesterol is found in your cells, in animal cell wall, cell membranes, that stabilizes the cell membrane. So cholesterol stabilizes membrane. Now the only problem here, we had a little study with our house data there. One of the characteristics of prokaryotic cells that I didn't tell you is they're incapable of synthesizing sterols. So this guy cannot make cholesterol. But if you look at his membrane, he's got cholesterol. So how does that come up? Where is mycoplasma going to get its cholesterol?
From the patient.
Okay? So you provide it. If you grow this organism in the lab, we have to add fetal calf serum as a source of cholesterol. So they can stabilize the membrane, otherwise it wouldn't lyse. It's always bad that about cholesterol. Yeah, but it's also essential for our membrane. We have a lot of membranes, right? 100 trillion cells have a lot of membranes. So we have, or 10 trillion cells. So we have mycoplasma. Doesn't have endotoxin, doesn't have a cell wall, doesn't have a flagella, doesn't have a capsule, doesn't have any of this stuff, so how does it cause a problem? Well, it turns out this organism does a weird thing to our immune system. It stimulates T cells to divide. It's a T cell mitogen. And the alveolar wall, which is normally one thick layer thick, now becomes three or more layers thick. And oxygen exchange is greatly inhibited. So the person walks around with a mild fever and a dry cough, a non-productive cough, that's sort of a smoker's cough. They're not bringing anything up, not getting any mucus up. They just got this irritation in their lungs. It's a dry, non-productive cough, and it doesn't go away. And they have it for weeks, and they get a little fever, and they feel tired because the oxygen is changed. So they go to the doctor, and the doctor says, huh, penicillin. Give me penicillin, or something like it, and what happens? Nothing. So now you go back, a few more weeks later, they use erythromycin or a protein synthesis inhibitor, kills the organism. No problem. And now we get bits and pieces of the organism in the lung, and it continues to stimulate T cells to divide, and so the alveolar wall maintains thickness for another 6 weeks. All of it along the layers of the lung for oxygen exchange is repaired. So you might have had this 6 weeks before you went to the doctor, 6 weeks after you began treatment, but you had the wrong stuff, and then 6 more weeks to recover. 18 weeks? That is almost 4 months. So we call this walking pneumonia sometimes as well. It's a very long, progressive kind of problem, but it's generally not fatal. We'll talk more about problems later in terms of children and spreading disease and things like that. But you can understand it's the cell membrane and its impact on the immune system which triggers the problem. Have a good day.